Hello everyone, welcome to our new season. Our episode of today will cover the role of Turkey in regional conflicts. My name is Tom Wagenmakers.
And my name is Aga Bayramov. And today it's great pleasure to welcome our first speaker of this season, Dr. Mustafa Ali Sezal. I would like to give a brief information about his background and research. Dr. Sezal's current research focuses on critical and traditional security studies, European defense industry and policy, and depiction of security relations in popular culture. Previously, he worked extensively on Turkish foreign policy and Turkish politics in a regional context. Mustafa, welcome and thank you very much for being here together with us.
Thank you, Aga. Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure being here.
All right. Regarding the first question, right? Our topic today is the role of Turkey in regional conflicts. Yeah, would you like to provide us with a general picture of Turkey's role in regional conflicts first, before we dive deeper into the topic?
Yes, of course. I mean, of course, Turkey, as an important player in the region, has always been involved in what is going on in the region, in Balkans, in Middle East, in Caucasus. So it has always been a force there. But if we want to look into a more recent history, we can see that Turkey has certain shifting positions in the region. So what I want to perhaps focus first on is Turkish foreign policy. Well, let me first put it this way. With the AKP government coming into power in November 2002, first we did not see any real difference in foreign policy, foreign relations of Turkey. And so Turkey had kind of this continuation of neighborly relations with the region, especially after Turkish relations with Syria was desecuritized after 1998, when PKK leader Abdullah Öcalan was captured, and when with Greece, Turkish relations were again desecuritized and became very friendly after the 1999 earthquake. Since then, at that time, we had the coalition government and the foreign policy was led by İsmail Cem, which was based on friendliness and also historical ties with the immediate neighborhood. So this kind of policy continued when AKP first came into power. However, in time, after AKP consolidated its power and its own people started to be more active in foreign policy making, particularly Ahmet Davutoğlu became an important figure, first as a foreign policy advisor to Erdogan, and then afterwards being the foreign minister in 2009, Turkish outlook started to change a little. Of course, first it was zero problems with neighbors policy. So again, we saw that this trade-based relations and friendliness, but in this time, there have been more emphasis on our historical ties, especially based on Ottoman rule. And this kind of brotherhood rhetoric came to the fore, right? So this was the basic initial start of the things. But then when the Arab Spring happened, Turkish position significantly changed. Changed because it was finally the moment where Turkey could intervene in what was going on in the region and actually claim its, well, according to the policymakers, a rightful position as a great player in the region and design the politics in the region. So it started with the Middle Eastern intervention. The Syrian civil war obviously was thought to be a very important point for Turkey, and it has also ideological background as well. But we can talk about that if you want to further delve into. But it actually really started with the Syrian civil war, Turkish support for the opposition elements there against Assad regime. And then Turkey continued to pursue its own interest to become the leader of the region, and especially become the leader of the Sunni Muslim populations of the region. And then, of course, it kind of spilled over to other parts and other areas of policy as well.
Does that also have any relation with the Ottoman rhetoric that you were talking about the Sunni people? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Because it was always, there was this always two poles in the Islamic understanding, right? Iran as the leaders of the Shiite populations, and then the Ottomans as the Sunni, as the caliph of the Muslim world, right? So that's the rhetoric that started to revitalize.
So basically, you said the beginning of the AKP, let's say the ruling party, the decentralized or desecuritized, let's say, border policy shifted towards more securitized and intervention foreign policy. Do you mean that?
Yes, yes, exactly. Especially with Syria, because see, before the Syrian civil war, actually, Turkish-Syrian relations were its historical highest point with trade, free trade agreements, and ease of border passings and all these kind of things.
Yeah, and then spillover, where we can see this spillover, because right now there are several regional conflicts. 2020, we had Armenian-Azerbaijani conflict. Currently, we have Ukrainian-Russia conflict, that Russia invaded Ukraine. Do you observe this desecuritized approach, from desecuritized approach, more securitized approach in these different regions and different areas, where it is also not so much related maybe to directly to Ottoman, but a little bit indirectly?
Yes, yes, I actually see a certain trend there. So it's kind of more asserting Turkey's power. Of course, the initial region which Turkey wants to assert its power is the Middle East and also the Balkans, right? So it's this whole idea of the neo-Ottoman kind of an understanding, this civilizational rhetoric that actually covers all of these. But of course, this also means that Turkey needs to show it has power to affect what's happening in the region. So it needs to show through its sometimes military might, but also some economic power as well. And I would definitely see this with Karabakh conflict. And there's also this historical and national ties with the region and Azerbaijan as well. And with Ukraine, of course, you can always claim that connection as well, because Crimean Tatars were important for Turkey always, because they had to move from Crimea, and we have a big population of them in Turkey as well, but also this historical ties. Of course, some parts of Ukraine was under Ottoman control as well. You can still think in those terms, and Black Sea as an important strategic point as well. So I think these are all kind of connected to each other.
Very good. Tom, you want to follow up?
Yeah, I think what I found interesting is how Turkey positions itself vis-a-vis Russia, because we see there's conflicting interests in Syria, right? But then on Ukraine, sometimes Turkey has, well, supportive rhetoric towards Russia, and sometimes it's negative rhetoric. So how do you explain this shifting in rhetoric regarding Russia?
Yeah, well, Russia has always been a difficult actor for Turkey. Especially Russia as a superpower or a great power is always a threat from a very Turkish geopolitical understanding. Right? So it starts with, like, this is one of the reasons Turkey wanted to enter the NATO. So that's how Turkey became a member in 1952, right? So Turkey openly positioned itself against Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, right? But after the end of the Cold War, these relations actually at the end of the Cold War, but there during even Cold War, there were some rapprochements between Turkey and Russia. And that was always problematic. That always caused certain tensions with the Western allies as well. So it kind of continued several times. But after the end of the Cold War, of course, Turkey more went into this getting close relations with the Turkic states of Central Asia as well. So kind of for a new market, in a sense, and some kind of a renewal of relations. But then with Russia, with especially Putin coming into power and Russian policies became more aggressive, Turkey found itself in a difficult position. Because, of course, as a Black Sea country, you need to have certain relations that you need to really maintain with such a big power. Also, it's an important trading partner, especially before 2015, when Turkey downed a Russian jet in the Mediterranean. Turkish construction companies were also very big in Russia, right? And also Turkey had this whole visa-free travel to Russia as well. So we had actually very good relations even after 2014. And Russian tourists are one of the major source of income for Turkish tourism industry. So on many levels, Turkish-Russia relations are important. So it is difficult for Turkey to
take one-sided approach.
Basically. Yes, that's why in Ukraine, yes, Turkish rhetoric is usually more on the Ukrainian side, but it's not anti-Russia. So that's perhaps what we can say. Yeah. And of course, with the whole Bayraktar drone sales in Ukraine and also production of it with Ukraine, on the one hand, on the other hand, Turkey actually becoming some sort of a safe haven for some Russian oligarchs who are under sanctions in the EU and in the West, Turkey tries to walk on a very difficult balance between Indeed. Two sides.
Yeah, and speaking on this Turkish Bayraktars, which has played a strong role within Turkey's own, let's say, security and also outside, as you said, in Central Asia, Caucasus, now in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Do you observe different way of, let's say, viewing this new technology or advanced drone technology of Turkish drones from the Western perspective? When we look at the Karabakh conflict, when we look at the Ukrainian conflict or any other conflicts, do you observe here a little bit maybe unbalanced or very opposite reactions from the Western powers regarding Turkish technology involvement, military technology involvement in these areas?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's interesting. Of course, it is a very successful technology, we have especially seen it in the Karabakh war, but also in Ukraine, and also Turkey has been using these in its own conflicts as well. So as a piece of technology, it is it's actually remarkable, especially considering how it's kind of cheaper and easy to produce, obviously. And I think you're right. There is some sort of perhaps a double-sided approach to this. So when these drones are in Karabakh, it's viewed differently. And when they're in Ukraine, then they're applauded. Right. So there is that kind of an understanding, a problematic approach, because at one point, for example, some parts could not be obtained from some Western powers because they stopped providing them because yes. Turkey was using these drones, for example, in its fight with PKK or the Kurdish separatist movement. But when it's in Ukraine and it's targeting Russian tanks and other targets, then it's a very fascinating technology. Mm-hmm. And also, of course, there's the political economy under this as well. Because when you enter this market, you suddenly become an important player. Mm-hmm. And then this, of course, undermines who are actually the initial dominant players in drone market, right?
Exactly.
So US or Canada or whoever. There's also that problem as well. So initially, they might have been afraid of that too. But then in Ukraine, it actually helps them perhaps decrease somehow their own commitment to spending more money about these. But yeah, in essence, I think you have a point there. There is some imbalance.
Yeah. So basically, it's a very good point because we can see here a political perspective, security perspective, and financial perspective. Because I remember during the Karabakh conflict, second Karabakh war time, I was reading Dutch news, and then these drones by several Dutch newspapers, such as the Trouw or other newspapers, were described as a kamikaze drones. But for the Ukrainian conflict, NOS described this Dutch, let's say the media described these drones as the poor man's air force. And I remember indeed Canada blocked trading drone cameras with Turkey because it was used in Karabakh conflict. So, but I didn't know also, yeah, of course I assumed, but good to highlight that there is also financial interest and aim behind this to protect your own kind of monopoly. Although some Western countries, of course, always highlight this liberal free market stuff, but sometimes they like to keep their monopoly on this military technology.
Yes, of course.
Yeah. I think that this poor man's army also has more to do with the Western perspective of the Ukrainian army than maybe rather of the drones, right? Because the Ukrainian army was seen as initially very weak, and then the drones were the savior. Whereas, as we know now, it's not just the drones.
Indeed. So basically, yeah, that's what I also mean. They could also say another, like, you know, like the Turkish kamikaze drones maybe helping the Ukrainian army, but this rhetoric changed from negative to positive.
Yeah.
Even there is a famous Ukrainian music on Bayraktar as well.
Yes.
So the security, when it doesn't threaten Western in security interests, like in Ukraine we see, it is presented and viewed positively. But when it is kind of challenged, it is viewed negatively in the case of Karabakh conflict. Do you want to follow up on?
I had an interesting thought. Well, it's not per se a regional conflict, but a conflict between Turkey and the European Union. Because for a long time, Turkey has been on the candidate list, right, for negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we all understand that that's not going to happen. Why is Turkey not pulling out if Turkey doesn't actually want to join the EU? Or does Turkey still want to join the EU?
Well, that's a tough question. Well, Turkey has been a negotiating candidate since 2005, right? So it's been 17 years, basically. And I remember how we actually celebrated when we became a candidate country. That was the highlight of perhaps Turkish politics as well. And at that moment, at that time, majority of Turkish people wanted to join and believed that Turkey could be a part of the European Union. Despite what happened with the Cypriot membership of the EU. So even then, still, majority of Turkish people wanted, right? Mm-hmm. Also, one of the ideas, well, not ideas, but the reasons behind it was that membership entailed lots of economic help, but also it meant that Turkish democracy has evolved in a place that it was on par with what was like France or Germany or whatever. So rule of law and democratic values, human rights, and everything seemed to be on par, right? So that was a positive thing. And that's what I believe that European Union at that time also thought it was like that. But of course, that has been, the European Union membership has been an important part of AKP's propaganda machine. Initially, it was for the EU membership because what was needed for AKP was, of course, getting military, because traditionally Turkish military was involved in politics. And of course, that is definitely against the principles of the EU, right? So civil military relations was also kind of reformed with this candidature, with this whole accession process, right? So AKP needed that to consolidate power. So that's why on a governmental level, on every level, Turkey wanted to join. And then when we became candidate, it was, when the negotiation started, it was 2005. AKP was still in its early years, and it was still kind of involved lots of other liberal or more centrist people involved, or it was more of a coalition back then. And then through time, as its power was consolidated, AKP went back to its roots, which is basically a Islamist political party. And Erdogan has his own ambitions. And so EU was just a means, actually. It wasn't the end, but the means for the politicians and AKP. So when the tides changed, now Turkey could actually be really criticize the EU on lots of things. And of course, there are lots of rightful points there as well. EU has not been very straight with Turkey, right? So it was, it goes both ways. I don't know how much EU wanted initially Turkey, but at least that keeping each other at bay has been a good policy for both sides, because both for domestic audiences in Turkey as well. So it was EU was always a great prospect for especially minorities, oppressed populations in Turkey, but also the more Western-oriented people would love to be a part of the EU, mm-hmm. right? But you can play with that whenever the wind changes, and if you go towards a more Islamic civilization way, then you can construct the EU again as the other, and you can use that, they will never take us in because we are different than them. So you kind of create that binary easily to consolidate your constituency, But also in EU, that helps as well. EU can also show that, look, that's a totally different civilization. We don't have the same values.
But so basically from both sides.
Yeah.
So the EU side was not coherent in terms of carrot and stick. And then Turkey observed this and used it for it is changing foreign policy to justify maybe not only failure, but this imbalance towards Turkey.
Yeah, exactly. Like
highlighting.
Like look at the migration crisis and the deal between Turkey and the EU. It's basically blackmail, which EU volunteered into, right? Like it's very
kind of blackmailing problematic. Each other.
Yeah.
But if it's then right now better for the AKP to other the EU, why stay in the negotiations? Because right now they are in line with the other, which might be right the opposite of what they want. Or is it useful?
Because it's useful. You don't want to cut those ties. But right now, no one in Turkey believes that Turkey will be a EU member. I don't see it. Of course, what happened through the years and what Turkish people see with the EU, especially one of the discourses or arguments in Turkey after the membership of Bulgaria and Romania was that, okay, not every EU member fully
fulfilled
the criteria, but still for some reason they can get in. But why cannot we get in? Yeah, right? Yeah. So
I want to return back to the regional conflict aspect as well, and also the final question from my side is, can we see not only the Turkish rule not providing military technology to the regional conflicts, but also a peace platform, kind of a mediator role? Because what we can observe recently, Turkey played a significant role in Ukraine prisoner exchange, and a significant amount of prisoners, including Western volunteers who were fighting on behalf of the Ukrainians or on the side of Ukrainians, were thanks to Turkey also successfully negotiated with Russia and played important role. So can we see also a kind of a platform where Turkey is trying to not only present itself as a military and security wise but also peace process?
Definitely Turkey tries to present itself that way, and with these recent negotiations it tries to do some of these things. So there is that element that's again trying to assert power, show power in these areas as well, trying to be a mediator. But I don't think that's very much at the heart of Turkish foreign policy in its neighborhood right now. It seems a very strategic act to be able to do that. And also, since Turkey does not have a very definitive position in the conflict, it can play this card as well. And of course, Turkey also needs gas. Turkey also needs lots of stuff. Turkey needs this commerce to continue. And Turkish economy is in a terrible shape right now. Not because of the war. It was already bad when the war happened, but war made it worse. So in that sense, Turkey needs to try to increase its profile somehow to actually remedy that, and so that it can perhaps garner some support from also the West as well. Like think about this whole NATO issue with Finland and Sweden. Turkey actually didn't say yes immediately and negotiated a deal with these two countries, right? Mm-hmm. Of course, I mean, we're talking about international politics. You are usually self-interested, but it's also like it's not Turkey as a mediator or tries to ease things, but it just right now Turkish regime needs certain elements from both the West and the East and the actors so that the regime stays legitimate in Turkey, right? Mm-hmm. So in all of these, we still need to look at the domestic politics, and we need to see that Erdogan wants to stay in power. And to ensure that, he takes all he can get from Russia, the EU, the US, or the Middle East, right? So it's kind of a strategic thinking in terms of keeping power.
So it's interconnected, domestic foreign policy, also economic benefits, in a sense that considering the globalized right now relations and the globalization, so it influences this Ukrainian-Russian conflict, influences basically everyone from regional to global perspective, from food security to energy security and the prices. Well, interesting points. Thank you so much, Mustafa, for joining us today. It was a great pleasure to host you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I also want to thank our listeners as well for listening to us. And please follow us on platforms, different platforms, and follow our next episodes as well. Thank you so much and have a wonderful day.
Yes, see you next time. Bye-bye.